Since the promise of 40 acres and a mule to former slaves by Union General William T. Sherman in 1865, reparations have been on the agenda for former slaves and their descendants. While that continues to be an unresolved issue, there is the story of Henrietta Woods, as told in the book Sweet Taste of Liberty, a true story of slavery and restitution in America by W. Caleb McDaniel. Her story goes as follows. In 1848, she was freed from slavery by her mistress in Cincinnati. But in 1853, just as she was settling into freedom, she was kidnapped, brought to Kentucky, and re-enslaved. In 1870, she filed a lawsuit against her re-enslaver, Zebulon Ward, and won a settlement in 1878. The author, W. Caleb McDaniel, is an associate professor of history at Rice University in Houston. Caleb McDaniel, welcome to KAZI Book Review.
Thanks for having me.
Caleb, how did you discover the story of Henrietta Woods?
I first learned about Woods' story in 2014 from an interview that she gave in an Ohio newspaper back in 1879. At the time, I was actually doing research on a different topic. I was learning about enslaved people who were forced to Texas during the Civil War by Confederate planters who were trying to evade emancipation. And a colleague of mine who knew I was working on that topic ran across Woods' interview in which she talks about having that same experience, and he sent it along to me. But the more I read about her story, the more I became interested in finding out more, and that became the whole book.
And she was actually brought across the border by Gerard Brandon, who I believe that Zebulon Ward, who initially arranged the kidnapping of her, who ran a prison in Kentucky, actually sold her to Brandon.
That's right. She was born enslaved in Kentucky, but she received her freedom papers in Cincinnati, as you mentioned at the beginning. And then she was kidnapped by Ward and re-enslaved, but then sold to slave traders who took her to Natchez, Mississippi, and she was sold there to Gerard Brandon, who later brought her to Texas.
So the story of freed slaves or free people of color being kidnapped is really not that new. And it really came to the consciousness of America in a big way with the movie 12 Years a Slave, which is based on the memoirs of a former slave, Solomon Northup. So how much kidnapping of freed slaves was going on there? Because reading the story of Henrietta, even after she was freed, she wasn't always being paid what she was promised. In some cases, she wasn't being paid at all. So being given your freedom as a former slave did not necessarily give you the economic wherewithal or the true freedom that people were looking for.
That's absolutely right. And one of the points that I hope the book will convey to readers is how fragile freedom was, especially in the sort of lower north border states in the antebellum period. Many people who lived just across the Ohio River were endangered by their proximity to slave states and the operations of kidnapping gangs.
So she really fought. Once she was kidnapped, she told her kidnappers that she was free. Her papers were back at the house of the lady that she was working for. She didn't take it lying down.
No, she did not. And she was determined that her story be told. And to me, that's one of the most amazing things about her story is how often she moved the story along by making sure that people knew what had happened to her.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to KAZI Book Review on KAZI 88.7 FM. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is Caleb McDaniel. He is the author of Sweet Taste of Liberty, A True Story of Slavery and Restitution in America. So talk about the process of researching the book once the story was shared with you of Henrietta Woods.
Well, the first step was to find the names and details and places that she mentioned in her interview, and then seek out other sources that could give me clues to find more. A real breakthrough came about a year after I learned about her first interview when I traveled to Chicago and found the case file of the lawsuit that she had won against Zebulon Ward in the 1870s. And that file contained all kinds of additional clues about her story. Shortly after that, I learned of another interview that Wood gave in 1876 to a Cincinnati journalist, which gave even more details about her life. So it was a process of connecting dots and seeing if I could find more sources. And I was really amazed by how detailed and accurate her memories were, and how, you know, even though it can be difficult sometimes to find about the lives of enslaved and formerly enslaved people, that she had left so many breadcrumbs in telling her story that made it possible to reconstruct what had happened.
So you're a historian of slavery, abolitionism, transatlantic reform, and the 19th century United States, at least according to the Rice University website. So when did you first decide as a history major, and you went to Texas A&M for undergrad and to obtain a master's degree, but when did you first decide that of all the subjects in history that you really wanted to concentrate on, that you really wanted to look closely at slavery and abolitionism?
Well, actually, it's, you know, you mentioned earlier the 12 Years a Slave movie that I think brought to attention so many people to Solomon Northup's story. For me, one of the movies that captured my attention when I was in high school was Steven Spielberg's Amistad movie. And I was interested after that in reading more about the experience of enslaved Africans and also abolitionists who fought in that period, and read a book about the gag rule in Congress that actually prevented for a time petitions against slavery being filed in the House of Representatives. And so that got me interested in abolitionism, the subject of my first book, which led to my interest in slavery in Texas and the Civil War and Henrietta Wood.
So how unusual was it when she was freed by her mistress in April of 1848 in Cincinnati? How unusual was it for a slave to be freed?
Well, it was fairly unusual, and some states actually had pretty strict laws around manumission. And so many slaveholders, though, actually learned how to use those jurisdictional differences to move across state lines and in ways that served their own best interests. The readers of the book will discover that Jane Seroed, the woman that helped Wood get her freedom papers in 1848, that her motives, in fact, are a little bit difficult to discern. She, at the time, was faced with many creditors who were actually trying to locate Seroed and to capture any assets she might have had. And so it's quite possible that Seroed decided to move Wood to Ohio from Kentucky just to evade those creditors. It wasn't necessarily because of a desire to see Wood free.
Wow. Wow. That's absolutely fascinating. And the other thing that really comes out in the book is the role that I believe that the lady that freed her, that her children played, and the person that she was working for and selling her back into slavery. So even though her mistress had freed her in 1853, it was her children, I believe, that worked against her ultimately, and the lady she was working for to sell her back into slavery.
That's right. When they thought of Wood, they really thought of the money that they could make by selling her into the interstate slave trade. And so they disagreed with Seroed's decision to take her to Cincinnati and were instrumental in the plot that led to her freedom being taken away.
So what was the reaction of the courts? Because one of the reasons that Zebulon Ward ended up selling her across to Brandon in, I believe, in Mississippi was because he was afraid of her continuing to go back to court or applying to mm-hmm. officials, continuing to mm-hmm. make the case that she was actually free.
Right. We were talking earlier about her determination to tell her story. And one of the consequences of that was that when she was kidnapped in 1853, she told what had happened to a sympathetic innkeeper in one of the hotels where she was confined by her kidnappers. And that led to a freedom suit actually being filed on her behalf in Lexington, Kentucky. That suit dragged on for a couple of years, and ultimately she lost that case. But it did sort of highlight the concern that Ward had that she might continue to seek out the aid of the courts in proving that she was a free woman.
And he wanted to make sure she was sold to a plantation so she'd have less access to potential advocates on her behalf.
Right. It was a lot easier for slave traders who operated in the Deep South to distance victims of kidnapping from allies who might have been willing to assist them. I think you can see that in Northup's story that you mentioned earlier. And in his narrative, he actually refers to the fact that there were hundreds of other people that he knew of, like him, who had been abducted from the free states and even as he was writing his memoir, were still toiling away on plantations. And in fact, Wood was one of those people. He didn't know of her, but there were many people like her that did not regain their freedom until after the Civil War.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to KAZI Book Review on KAZI 88.7 FM. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is Caleb McDaniel. He is the author of Sweet Taste of Liberty, A True Story of Slavery and Restitution in America. What was the environment like in Ohio for people of color who were free in the 1840s and 1850s?
Well, they definitely faced an environment of anti-black racism, and they also faced a patchwork of laws that were really designed to keep them in a position of second-class citizenship. The so-called black laws that were passed in Ohio in the early national period were explicitly designed to try to discourage people of color from migrating to the state. By the time that Wood was kidnapped, some things were changing due to the work of free black activists in the city who had opposed the black laws and had successfully worked for the repeal of some of them by the end of the 1840s, but it was still a sort of precarious freedom that people of color in Cincinnati possessed in the antebellum period.
It was such a surprise to read that, of course, that she won the case, even though she had applied for $25,000, I believe, and only ended up with $2,500, or applied for $20,000 for back wages. And when we think of the key court cases, of course, there's 1876 Plessis versus Ferguson Supreme Court case, which sort of reinforced or created the judicial framework for separate but equal. We think about the Dred Scott case. So it's a surprise that she won. What do you attribute her success in winning this case finally in 1878 to?
It is an amazing victory, and that's what sort of drew me to want to learn more about her story. You put your finger on it when you mentioned the Dred Scott case. You know, here's a case that in 1857 had said that people of African descent had no right to file a suit in any federal court. And then here, you know, 20 years later, Wood was able to win this lawsuit. It's a testament to how much the Civil War and Reconstruction really had transformed the American legal landscape with the passage of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. But as you also noted, this was a window of opportunity that closed very rapidly by the end of the century. And even in the 1870s, when Wood was litigating her suit, courts were increasingly hostile to black litigation. And in fact, we're making it harder for people to file suit in federal courts for claims like hers. I think she was fortunate in a way, we can say that, that she was able to point to this case of abduction or kidnapping, and that gave her a sort of unique legal standing in the court that millions of enslaved people who had never acquired their freedom before the Civil War didn't have the same grounds to bring before the court and make their lost wages and enslavement an issue that courts had to address.
To what degree do you think her winning the case and receiving the money played in her son successfully becoming a lawyer? Because the big discussion about reparations, which has been discussed recently in Congress, and it's been an ongoing discussion, as I said in the introduction, going all the way back to 1865, is the what if those funds, if former slaves were actually given reparations, how much better off African Americans who are descended from slaves would be today. Because if you look at all the economic data, whether you're talking about unemployment rates, whether you're talking about household wealth, whether you're talking about medium household income, the African American community continues to be very far behind the white community. And to a large degree, you can look at that lack of relative economic success to the lack of the ability to have the generational transfer of wealth, because there was no wealth, generally speaking, to be transferred over, whether we're talking about starting off with nothing as a former slave to those who actually had land, had built up some wealth and had it stolen from them.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was very much one of the questions that I wanted to investigate when I started research on the book. When I learned about Wood's interview in 2014, of course, only a few months before Ta-Nehisi Coates had published his award-winning article on the case for reparations, and it occurred to me that while there were many cases for and against reparations in the political sphere, we didn't have many cases of reparations or restitution that we could look to answer questions like that. And so I did want to know, what impact did restitution have for Wood? And it seems pretty likely to me that it had a direct impact on her son's later career. After her legal victory, she and her son, who was actually born enslaved in Mississippi, moved to Chicago, and he was able in the 1880s to purchase a house outright for, I believe the amount was $1,600 or thereabouts. And this was actually very rare. Black home ownership rates in the 1880s were very low. And in fact, to purchase a home at all in Chicago just with wages from a wage-earning job was difficult to do. So it seems to me that the money that Wood won, that capital, benefited him. He was able to get into the real estate market and then use that house as an asset to take out loans and fund his legal education and establish a better foothold for himself and his family than he otherwise would have had.
Do you believe her successful case could be a path for supporters of reparations that they could follow? That is, by identifying ancestors that were slaves and the value of the wages they could have earned if they weren't enslaved. Now, I know you're not a lawyer, you're a historian, but I have to ask that question.
No legal advice. But I do think if you look at the movements for reparations today, many advocates are shifting strategy to focus on the complicity of federal and state governments in maintaining slavery and seeking to do through legislation instead of litigation what's needed to redress the harms of slavery across generations. I think that's partly because some of the other efforts at the beginning of this century to file lawsuits against, for example, banks or other institutions that had a stake in slavery weren't well received in the courts for a variety of reasons. And so this sort of necessitated a different strategy that focuses more on legislation.
You know, what's really good is the actual article that was written. And I believe the Cincinnati newspaper is actually available online. Story of a slave kidnapped in Covington 20 years ago and illegally sold in the Cotton States. And it was, as you shared earlier, was told to a reporter for the Cincinnati Commercial newspaper. Mm-hmm. And one of the things is you talk about how he didn't actually capture everything that she shared with him because she shared some of the brutality that she saw as being a slave. And she and one of the most searing images in my mind is her talking about seeing a female slave being beaten to death. And the other thing was it wasn't just the white male slave owners that were pushing for harsh punishment for slaves. It was also in this case that she shared the mistress of the plantation.
I think that's a very important point. And in fact, Stephanie Jones Rogers, a great historian at University of California, Berkeley, has just published a book that focuses on the complicity of white women in the slaveholding South. But you're absolutely right that the interviews that Wood gave don't give us access to everything that she saw. And in fact, Lafcadio Hearn, who was the commercial reporter in 1876, mentioned that some of the scenes that she recounted, in his view, were too horrible for publication. So I think as a historian writing the book, I was trying to be sensitive to the point at which her story sort of trails off and we can't know the whole story. And in a way, that tells us as much about slavery as if we did know everything, that it's difficult to recover those traumas of the past and to represent them in a way that actually gets close to their experience.
I think reading your book, Henrietta Wood is really a historic, heroic figure, someone who probably didn't know how to read and write, had to sign an X to the contract when she went to work for her former slave owner. And I believe back in Mississippi after the war ended, the fact that when she was kidnapped, that she continued to advocate for her rights and to continue to tell her story, and the fact that she had the wherewithal and the desire to advocate for what was right when she had an opportunity to, and stayed with the whole time until she actually won in 1878. She's truly a heroic figure.
Oh, I agree. It's amazing the resilience that she showed to survive enslavement twice, and then to make sure that she held Ward to account. One of the quotes that I end the book with is from Martin Luther King Jr., who famously said that freedom is never given by the oppressor; it has to be demanded by the oppressed. And to me, her story is illustrative of that theme in African-American history.
I want to talk a little bit about the article you wrote for the Atlantic magazine in 2017, and the name of it was "The South Only Embraced States' Rights as It Lost Control of the Federal Government." And you wrote, essentially, the nation worked for slaveholders, even to the point of overruling northern states' rights. Not surprisingly, those slaveholders were powerfully committed to the Union, on whose power they depended. As long as the nation worked for them, they worked for the nation. So what changed to make secessionists desert the country they loved? In brief, the rise of the Republican Party and the election of Abraham Lincoln, who refused to use national power to advance slavery any longer.
Wow. Yeah, I think that's something that that readers hopefully will discover from this book, too. People may be surprised to learn that Zebulon Ward, the man who kidnapped and enslaved Wood and that she later sued, was actually a Unionist during the Civil War, and he wasn't alone in that. There were, especially in the border slave states like Kentucky, many pro-slavery Unionists, conservative Unionists, who believed that the Union and the Constitution best protected their interests as slaveholders. And so that was one of the points that I was trying to draw out in that Atlantic article as well, that, you know, much later, former Confederates pointed to states' rights as their primary motive. But at the time, everyone was very clear that their cause was identified with slavery, and that their major concern was Abraham Lincoln and the Republican Party and the threats that they posed to slavery.
So were you surprised as a historian when you were doing your research and discovered that the whole states' right argument for why the Confederacy succeeded, the states in the Confederacy succeeded for the Union was a, well, I can't say what I want to say, but was not true, know, misleading?
It's a point that historians and scholars, I think, are pretty united by. I mean, it's not something that's surprising to those who have looked at the sources, but it is surprising sometimes the hold that a denial of the role of slavery in the coming of the Civil War continues to have outside the academy. And, you know, we see that in ongoing struggles about the place of Confederate symbols and monuments in our public life, or even in the state capitol in Austin. It's something that I think historians and the public need to do a better job of getting the word out of what actually happened.
Well, I think we're all pretty clear when you read the documents, the Articles of Secession for the Confederacy, and you read the history. Mm-hmm. It was always clear that they seceded because they wanted to maintain slavery. I think people are generally aware of that. I think what people aren't aware of is that the leaders in the South, and the South was a strong supporter of the Union, of the federal government, until it no longer served their purpose.
To me, you know, one of the most striking images of that, I started off that Atlantic article with it, is that, you know, when John Brown led his raid on Harper's Ferry in 1859 and was surrounded and captured, the commander in charge of the U.S. troops who came to Harper's Ferry to put down his rebellion was none other than Robert E. Lee. So many of these men who went on to fight for the Confederacy had certainly supported the Union and the nation, as I said, until it no longer supported their interest in slavery.
What's been the reaction to your book?
I actually have been impressed that people are interested in learning about this and hearing more about someone like Wood. I think she, as you put it earlier, is a person who's hard not to admire and to root for as you're reading along. And I'm hopeful that a personal narrative like hers can connect with readers who might, you know, already have their minds made up about various political positions on reparations or sort of big abstractions. I think we need stories like Wood's to remind us of what the human impact of slavery was and how long the struggle to win justice has been going on.
Caleb McDaniel, author of Sweet Taste of Liberty, A True Story of Slavery and Restitution in America. And when you look for the book, it'll actually be W. Caleb McDaniel. What does the W stand for, Caleb?
William, family name.
Thanks for being a guest on KAZI Book Review.
Thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed talking with you.